Greetings and salutations from the Agile Revolution. Oh, I get that one. Agile, Greg. Yeah, it's been a long day here. It's been a long day here at Yow. I'm Tony, obviously.
I'm Craig. We're at Yow, Brisbane. We don't say the year.
We don't say the year because you know
it's Yow.
It's Yow.
Yeah, but we're really lucky to have Jessica Kerr with us. How are you doing, Jessica?
Very good, thank you.
So you're here giving two talks, a keynote, as well as another added bonus talk, which is awesome. But it's great to have you out here. Is this your first time to Australia? Second time. When were you last out here?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Of course. That's correct. Yeah. Yes, I knew I'd ran it. Well, I mean, I've been involved with other conferences that you've been at as well. So, yeah, I forgot that. So, welcome back.
Thanks.
So, Tony, you were at both talks the last couple of days.
Absolutely brilliant. I think you really struck a note with a lot of the audience. And interestingly enough, as they were all walking, there was lots of buzz going on. So I think you got them thinking.
Sweet.
Do you want to give our listeners a little bit of a taste of the keynote?
Oh, sure. So the keynote is about the Florentine Camerata, which is the group that invented opera. I learned about this from like a great course of music history. I am not a music history person, but you know, a little bit about a topic is the most interesting bit anyway. Right, so I investigated the Florentine Camerata and I found this article in the Journal of the History of Ideas. And it was also focused on the aspect of the Camerata that interests me, which is that it's kind of like an invisible college in science. It was a group of people out of whom an idea emerged. But the other thing that happens with that group of people that's busy learning together to solve a problem is that they each learn as individuals and become greater than they were before. So the members of the Camerata, they published treatises in science and history and philosophy and also poetry and of course some opera, but like 15 of those people have Wikipedia articles today, and this is from like the 16th century. So what's interesting is it's one very clear case of a great team making great people, and great teams make great people. People think it's the other way around, but I've had plenty of like I've been part of plenty of groups of several great developers that were just okay as a team. Whereas everyone I know who's like senior and confident, we all can point to at least one team that was formative for us, that really changed us and we learned so much and new ways of thinking and connections and we're still in touch and yeah, and stop acting like it's about the people. The weird thing is, and this is part of the talk too, is that if you want to become great as a developer, focus on the team. One part that really resonates is the story of the purple developer. The purple developer, who just happens to be drawn in purple, knows a system really well because they wrote it, and then if they want to move on, they've got to pass that knowledge, that mental model that they have of the system, on to other developers. So here come the blue developer and the green developer, and they've been assigned to this project, probably part-time, and they're supposed to pick up a mental model. Purple doesn't know how much they know. These are the unknown knowns here, and it is really hard to get that information into blue and green. You can't document what's obvious to you. One thing I sometimes say is whenever you say the word obviously, replace it with I can't explain it but.
Yeah.
Because there's some stuff that after a while we just know stuff so deeply that we can't even tell people why it is. It's common sense to us. But everything that's obvious now wasn't always. Some of that stuff that I learned from my camaradas of the past, it just feels innate to me now, and I can't teach it one-on-one. You've got to like learn it in a team.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when you are the purple developer and you have a good mental model of the system, the trick is to stop changing it, because you can change it faster. So you can keep changing it so fast that blue and green will never get a grasp on it. Instead, change it only through the fingers of blue and green. And this is where pair programming or mob programming are so crucial, because as the expert, you've got to get your hands off the keyboard. Everything you do is messing with their attempts to figure it out. And you've got to let them type it, and most importantly, let them ask the questions. How did you know to do that? Why did you look there? How would I test this?
I was actually we were talking to Kent Beck earlier, and I was recounting when I first read his test driven development book and the, mm-hmm. and the baby steps, and I remember when watching people try and teach new programmers how to do test driven development. But of course, as you get better at test driven development, instead of doing the one line of code, one test, you might go and test 10 lines of code, and of course you watch these junior people come in and they go, why did you do that? And that's exactly it, is that as you get good, you forget about the way you learnt and started, and you have to go back to basics and baby steps to bring people along for the journey. And interestingly, as you do that, you learn more things as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so that's great. True.
You learn from teaching.
And I think the new cool world now.
Semathesy?
That's it, semathesy.
It's hard to say. Emphasis on the math.
On the math.
Semathesy. It means a living system made of living parts. And the key flow in the system is mutual learning, because all the parts are learning from each other as well as from their environment. And the environment is learning from this system as well. And Nora Bateson, who's an anthropologist, coined this term to contrast with the mechanical system, because systems thinking is super important, but if we think of it mechanically, we're missing it. It's not just the parts. It's not just the relationships with the parts. It's the way all those interactions change the parts so that the semathesy is never the same from day to day. Our teams are totally like this because we're constantly learning from each other. And this, to me, explains why great teams make great people, because we learn so much better in a group. We learn when we sit and work directly with people. That's how we really pass knowledge and know-how. And then in a development team, we're also learning from our software, and our software is learning from us. So the code itself becomes part of the team. Meanwhile, the people in the team have a mental model of the software, which is intricately connected with how the software is working. You can't separate those and expect to move forward.
Mm, absolutely. And so, the other talk you gave here was on yak.
Yeah, yak shaving. Shaving the golden yak.
Yeah.
I think yak shaving is highly underrated. First of all, for people who don't know, the expression yak shaving, it doesn't matter what it is. It's just a phrase that makes you say, why would you do that? And it refers to all the little tasks that you wind up doing because they got in the way of your work. They're not what you wanted to accomplish, but they're getting in the way, or they're going to get in the way if you don't fix them now. Just stuff that you're tripping over, or hoops you have to jump through, like crap, the build is broken, or code review is a yak shave. But also a refactoring can be a yak shave. The common prejudice is that these are wastes of time. A few of them are, but I think a big part of my own happiness in my job has been accepting that all those little obstacles that pop up and get in the way of what I'm trying to do, those are my job. Now, it's my job to prioritize which ones do I go around right now and which ones do I fix properly, because there's a balance there. But I remember one day being so frustrated that I was trying to do something with the Travis CI API. And there's some requests that you have to give it a token. You have to give it an API token and be authenticated. And there's other requests that won't work if you do. It's fine if you don't give it a token, but if you do, even a valid token, it's like, no, it's just going to... I'm like, what? But I finally had to accept that, no, you know what? I am doing development automation. I need people to be able to integrate with Travis. This is my job. My job is to navigate this rocky island that is a piece of software that, honestly, it's free. I shouldn't complain. Mm. Yeah, so those things that just drive us bonko, they really are our job. And once I accept that, then I can be like, oh, I have accomplished something. I have learned about this API, and I can now put this in a README, or I can post it somewhere, or I can bitch about it on Twitter. That's also helpful.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? Is that there's the acceptance, but then it's what did you do about it to make it easier or better, or
right.
You just learn from it.
I can't fix the Travis API, I don't think, but I can make it easier for other people who encounter this obstacle to find the piece of information that they need, and I can embed this information in our open source libraries so that our users and our teams can benefit.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the other thing that you're talking about is domain-driven design. You're very passionate about that.
I am. I just really started looking into domain-driven design a couple months ago because I got invited to do this Mathesy keynote at Explore DDD, which is the U.S. domain-driven design conference in Denver. And I was
with our friend Paul Rayner?
Yeah, yeah. Right, that was Paul Rayner invited me to do that. And he was so right because this Mathesy keynote, it resonates with a lot of people, but especially with the domain-driven design people. And I think that community is really onto something. I think if you're an Agile person, but you kind of wish that Agile had more code in it now, just go to the domain-driven design conferences. They get both sides of the socio-technical system. And I've been studying it now because I'm like, why do these people have it right? What is it about domain-driven design that caused them to adopt microservices and event sourcing and CQRS? They were talking about immutability and explicit side effects and closure of operations. Those are things functional programming has been pushing now. And they adopted microservices and event sourcing early. And there's plenty of companies going, oh my God, microservices are killing us. Those are not the DDD people. Mm. The DDD people are like, yes, we have this and it's working because they're doing it right and for the right reasons. So what is it about domain-driven design? I think one of the things is that domain-driven design is very, very careful about making the code super expressive of the business domain. When we embed our business knowledge in the code very carefully in the domain, in our ubiquitous language, when we recognize that words don't have a meaning outside of context, context is first class in DDD, completely embraces Conway's law from the start. When we do that, we turn the code to our side in the battle against complexity. Because our code can add complexity to the system of work, or it can help us navigate the complexity of the business domain. And the crucial bit is we want complexity in the business domain. Because John Allspaugh points out that success begets complexity, and complexity is necessary for success. There's a growth loop between success and complexity in the business domain, not the technical side. Not the Netflix architecture of doom. Do we really need that? No, but in the domain of our business, you know, the stuff that makes our company different from other companies, the more cases we can support, the more customers we can accommodate, the more difficulties we can offload from our customers to our service or whatever it is. If my users don't have to know the quirks of the Travis API, if I put that complexity into my software, then I'm helping them, and that leads to more success, which means more people are using it and backwards compatibility and all that complexity. We need to embrace complexity on the business side. You still have to navigate it, you know, so you want to be careful with your modularity and be really, really careful with your naming and your language, but domain-driven design embraces that. And it makes the code a tool to help us learn about the business domain. Because code, it operates kind of like, you know how when you write out a blog post, you finally write something down, it forces you to like get your thinking in order. And you can't like wave your hands around. Yeah. And at the other extreme, there's a mathematical proof that forces you to be like completely logical and thorough and precise. Code is somewhere in the middle. It says working software is a proof that it generally hangs together. And so that can help us think more rigorously about the business domain. And I think that creates a growth loop between you've got the domain experts talking to the developers and building our knowledge of the business domain. And then the developers put that in the code, and then the domain experts look at the code. They can read it with guidance. So you don't even have to wait for a GUI to exist. They can look at it and say, does this really express the knowledge that's in my head? And so then the code actually becomes a tool to make us better at the business domain instead of I think a lot of software just adds to the difficulty of the business, the system of work.
And I think it, you know, because it is an asset, you know, but a liability at the same time. We don't invest enough in that in order to keep it maintainable, and that's what domain-driven design brings. It's interesting you were focusing on the domain side of it. I wonder whether, and you're talking about the success, I wonder what the other success is that it's driven design as well. That you know, one of the things is that we quite often just jump into the code, and so by forcing us to stop and think about the design, which was really, you know, test-driven development had the same promise, that promise was purely code driven, and so by talking about the design but doing that first also forces us into that short design loop phase, which ultimately ends up with better code.
Yeah. Although one thing that threw me off, and one reason it took me so long to get into DDD, was I thought it would be like TDD. Domain-driven design is so much bigger than TDD.
I get that, but I think, but it was my point was, mm-hmm. it's the driven design, right. Part of it.
I think that's our first sneeze on the podcast.
That is
our
first sneeze on the podcast.
That's it.
Tick.
Yeah, tick that off. We were talking earlier, and she said we should interject different things into the podcast.
There we go.
I think
that's
that was
one of them.
That was the first one.
Yeah, although the code becomes part of that really, really early in domain-driven design. You iterate super fast, and the code might not operate. You might be mocking things and just using little fillers or trivial implementations in memory stores instead of like real persistence kind of thing. You get the code involved in that. The code doesn't wait for the design. It participates in the design.
Yeah, that's probably my very bad way of explaining it. But yeah, it's driving that early, and our code is our artifact. It's the, you know, it is the living thing, as opposed to a document or a diagram or something over there. But you're right, it's that bringing the business along for the ride, you know, with that domain knowledge is so super important.
Yeah, because our limitation as developers is not how much we can do, it's how much we can know. And domain-driven design creates a growth loop in the direction of knowledge, the direction of increasing knowledge. So between the experts and the developers and the code, there's this growth loop that makes us know more and more. And that helps us make decisions, which is design. And that's our real job.
So I mean, it's interesting that you've sort of just come across this. I'm just wondering, have you got any thoughts about why, perhaps, because, you know, domain-driven design has been around for a lot of years now.
Mm-hmm.
Why has it not taken off and exploded and been more popular? Do you have any thoughts on that?
What people are morons.
You were in the bitch talk.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think we haven't. I mean, as an industry, we haven't figured it out yet. Eric Evans is awesome. I love him, but maybe he's not as charismatic as Kent Beck.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have as many bow ties.
True. but in extreme programming, hasn't it? Yeah, we were just talking to him, and that didn't win either, right? Because he didn't have a fancy certification to go along with it.
You know, the world isn't always ready for an idea. I was really surprised when I first gave this keynote about Semathesy that people got it. It like clicked with something they already had in their heads and gave them a word for it. I didn't expect that. But it turns out the world is ready for this one, or at least part of it. I don't think enough of the world has recognized how important the ideas in DDD are.
I've got a theory on that. So the semanthesis and why that particular thing is connecting with people.
Ooh.
My theory on that is because...
Don't get excited. It's not going to be great.
There's nothing like working with this guy to keep you level. Yeah. No, but my theory on that, and it was formed from my own thought when as soon as you started it, but I was also listening to people around me as we were walking out, because I tend to do that. And everybody had an example. Everybody had a thought. Everybody had a connection point to a team that they, as you said,
right.
that they'd been around.
Right.
And everybody had that moment where that whole organic moment connected with it. And I think, so what it is you've actually put something around it or put a words to something that they were thinking, but they didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah, they didn't know how much they knew.
Yeah. But design-driven development in the differential to that doesn't have that it's that thing over there. It's like when we first started talking about TDD or BDD or any of those wonderful acronyms we have. People look at it and go, what the hell is that?
That's a good point. This is a good point because one thing that I noticed since I've started looking into domain-driven design is I now recognize it in Atomist. So our company, we're working on changing the way software delivery is done so that it's code from the top down instead of jammed into little scripts or bash or GUIs. So that people have more control over their delivery, but it's still not hard. And one of the important elements that our CEO, Rod Johnson, has been on about since the beginning is that we need a model, a strong model of software, of the software development and deployment and operations process. So now I think that Atomist puts the DDD in DevOps. Because we do when you get to write your own software delivery and various other development automations in code on a strong model that we've created. And then there's a graph database so that you can go retrieve stuff. But that is another exemplar of the model. But the point is we've made things like a commit and a push, but also different kinds of changes and projects and deployments and builds and tags and various things. We've made these into, what do we call them? Participants in the domain. And that lets you code your delivery in the language that we talk about doing delivery instead of the language imposed by Jenkins or Travis.
Yeah, and it's a different domain language in the same way that you're writing code at, you know, whatever your business is, that, you know, you need to go and talk to air quotes business people and understand if I work for a bank that, you know, this is your word for credit and debit and those type of things. Mm-hmm. And in your case, it's the same thing. It's just a different domain.
Yeah.
But it's just as important because the art of software is not just solving this problem over here, but it's also getting in the hands of people.
And we are and we are the domain experts in that. And in our own software. And oh, I just lost something.
We were wondering if another sneeze was
coming. We thought it was a sneeze coming.
Oh, yeah, and you get to code it in a declarative style instead of declarative YAML. I'm sorry, when your YAML includes shell commands, that's not declarative.
Yeah, that's just wrapping one language around another language.
And not a very good language.
That's true.
I mean, Bash is awesome for use on my laptop, but there's reasons we have other programming languages since the 1970s.
Yes. So you mentioned Atomist, and it's interesting, I guess, someone like Rod Johnson, who you know, well known for Spring and other things, has now gone on to tackle this problem.
Yeah, he tried to retire. It didn't work. He needed to change the world again.
People like that just don't.
They just don't.
Yeah.
Look at Ken.
So what sort of people or industries are you expecting would use this product? What problem are you ultimately trying to solve?
In the end, I think most software companies, most companies that write software, so everyone, need their own deployment system, kind of like Netflix has Spinnaker, and Netflix open sourced that, and people try to use that, but that's the deployment system for Netflix. It's not the one for you. Now, if you're just starting out, great. Use Heroku, use Cloud Foundry, use whatever's easiest, because when you're just starting out, you can use exactly one. But as soon as you have legacy software, you're always going to need to do custom things. And your business has custom needs. You need your own auditing things. People have their own coding standards or their own security scanners. They have a process that there's a business need for, at least within the business of the software department. And we need to be able to create our custom ones. And so we do this by cramming it into Jenkins plugins, but I think we can do a lot better. We can write software to deliver software if we have the frameworks and the libraries and the service for triggering and storing the graph data. If we have that provided for us and we just get to write some functions to do the bits that are important or unique to our company, then we can each have our own Spinnaker. without a ridiculous amount of effort, and we can kind of take ownership of our software delivery a lot more.
So it's interesting. One of the reasons that people use a tool like Travis or Jenkins is that there's that belief that it's open and that they can change anything. Is there a danger if you keep adding like layers on top of the delivery, or does the ease of being able to write that language get around that problem?
Well, you can put Atomist on top of Travis or Jenkins, and I would do that initially just to integrate. And because you don't have to convert everything at once. But Atomist also, you can just do the CI right there. Mm-hmm. And then you get to dynamically generate your trees, not just pipelines, of what needs to happen on each deploy based on what you find in the project. So you never have to set up a pipeline ahead of time. It's event-driven, like DDD. Something was pushed to a repository. It doesn't matter that it's never seen that repository before. We can look at this code and then you get to decide in a function or whatever what needs to happen. Oh, it says Spring Web Service. I'm going to use this Spring Builder, and I'm going to maybe run check style on it. And most of our stuff is in TypeScript. And when I make a push, it checks it out. It runs the linter on it with autofix mode. And if I forgot to run the linter, which is every day, it's just going to fix it for me and make a commit to the branch. That's really pretty hard to do in Jenkins. Possible, but hard.
Which also eliminates that problem that lots of organizations have, particularly large organizations, that they want those controls for governance around there. And so that's always been the hard part, is that the smart companies, like your Netflix and others, have had the resources to be able to build those into those pipelines.
Well, now organization-wide automation around pipeline, and now everyone will have their resources because it won't be any harder and hopefully a lot less painful than configuring Jenkins. And you don't have to change the Jenkins file in every repository.
In fact, you could change from Jenkins to something else because you've removed that complexity from there as well.
Yeah, and you can do that gradually at whatever pace, because one thing that once you have an organization-wide delivery set up, then you can change it in an organization-wide way. Or you could break it down however. I mean, it's code. Decide what you want it to do.
So back to the domain-driven design.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's stories to be told about that. You need to get those stories out so that people hear the why.
They need to see themselves in it.
They need to see themselves in it. So much as what you've done with semantheses, it's the same thing. So people need to be able to see within that, why would I do this? How do I do this? And what are the examples? And what's the, it goes back to the old whiff of what's in it for me.
Oh, thank you. That is brilliant, because the best example to help people understand domain-driven design would be the domain of software. So I can just show them how to do stuff in Atomist.
Tick, I've done my good deed for the day.
I think that's the first brainwave you've given anyone ever.
No, that's
I'll
take that.
Oh dear. Well, we can talk to you for hours, Jessica, and what's been really, I mean, we've been walking around talking to people at the conference, and the people have been inspired. The amount of people have said, we've asked, what is your favorite talk, your keynote or the yak shaving one?
Oh,
yeah,
sweet.
One in has come up.
I love
there
it.
And so
yakbreeder.com.
It's so good. If you ever wanted to know about yaks, man, yakbreeder.com. They've got all the information and all the superlatives.
You've been inspiring audiences, and thank you for that, for sharing it. If people want to know more about you and find out what you're up to, where can they find out more?
Blog.atomist.com. That's where I post stuff these days. And Jessitron on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And obviously more about Atomist, they can find out more about that.
Yep, you can find that at atomist.com. Mm-hmm. There's also jessitron.com, which if you want to be completely reassured that I am not a front-end developer, that website will do it.
Yes, lots of rants. Just beware, rant alert. Right?
Yeah. Well, it's just a sad website, but that's okay.
It's
retro, like yakbreeder.com.
Be ready.
All right, so I guess seeing as we're at the end of it all, on the count of three, we'll...
Our little ending.
We'll do our little ending.
Okay.
Yeah. Join us. One, two, three.
Viva la revolution!
Excellent. Thank you.